Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. I am your host, Batabi Lebumtombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator. I am so glad you've decided to listen to the show today, and I hope you choose to participate by calling in. We have said it before, nothing can tear a family apart like financial difficulties. In these economic times, more families find themselves faced with sobering decisions. One of those decisions might be whether to file for bankruptcy. Today, my guest is Izoma Eze, JD, CPA, a practicing bankruptcy and tax attorney, and we are talking about the facts, myths, and potential benefits of filing for bankruptcy. Tomorrow is tax day in the United States, and you may have some last-minute questions. Get those ready, too, and listen for the phone number so that you can call in. You are listening to jazz French horn player Mark Taylor. Yes, that's right. I said jazz and French horn in the same sentence. This piece is called Broken, and it is from Mark's album, Circle Squared. Take a listen while everyone arrives, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Well, hello, everyone. If you're just joining the show, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. In mediation, you decide what fair is. Be your own judge. Settle your issues out of court. Contact me at info@123untangled.com. That's my email. Or visit my website at www.123untangled.com to learn more about my practice and what mediation can do for you and your family. You've been listening to jazz French horn player Mark Taylor, and the piece is called Broken from his album Circle Squared. For more information about the music on the show, email me at info@123untangled.com. And you're going to hear that email address a couple more times during the show, I hope, so that you can be sure to jot it down. And if you've been listening to the show regularly, you should have it by memory or from memory by now. info@123untangled.com. We're going to dive right into the show today. There's lots to talk about, and we want to make sure to have enough time to answer as many questions as possible. My guest is Zoma Eze, and he is a bankruptcy and tax attorney. I'm going to turn his mic on in just a second here, letting you know we're coming to you now. You're on the air. Zoma, how are you?
Fine, Batavile. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well, and I want to thank you so much for joining the show today, especially being that tomorrow is the day for a lot of people who are busy with their taxes. So it's especially timely that you're here talking about these financial issues today. Tell me a bit about your practice so that folks know, you know, how you can be helpful.
Okay, sure. As you said earlier, I'm an attorney practicing here in the city. My office is in Bowling Green. I have a solo practice law firm, and my practice areas essentially are taxes and bankruptcy, and I'm going to clear up what that means right now. It's a common. I'm also a CPA, by the way, but that's different. I practiced as a CPA before I became a lawyer. I still am a CPA, but right now my practice is almost is exclusively as an attorney.
Okay.
With regards to bankruptcy, it really speaks for itself. It's a situation where someone is experiencing financial difficulty, which is just everyone these days. So you say, well, that's kind of broad, but that's really what it is, because the question becomes, is my income going to go up? Am I a business person who's expecting to see my income jump in the next couple of months so that way I can get solvent again? Or am I expecting a promotion at work? Is something going to change in my life that's going to create more money coming in than what's going out? In
mm-hmm.
which case, you don't need to talk to me. If it's not looking like that, you might need to talk to someone like me. That's
yeah.
bankruptcy, right?
Okay.
Okay. On the tax side, I don't do tax returns. I guess I do, but for very limited clients. These are people who I already represent on other matters, and so if there's a tax return that they have and I don't want to have somebody else work on it, I'll do it myself. So it's really the exception rather than the norm that I do a tax return. But what a tax lawyer does or what I do is essentially represent you from the state of New York, IRS, all the way to the U.S. Tax Court where I'm admitted. And the idea is, you know, you get a summons. You get some kind of thing from the government, state or federal or local, and they say, hey, you owe taxes, and this is what we're going to do to you. You call me. My job is to make it go away. Negotiation.
First you freak out.
Litigation.
First you freak out, and then they call you so that they can stop freaking out.
Exactly. Yes, because you will freak out. There's no getting
okay.
around that. So.
Okay.
So that's what I call my tax litigation practice. It's essentially standing up for you. Someone wants to seize your, garnish your paycheck, levy your bank account, take assets from your company, take your house, put a lien on your house, whatever. The government is trying to take money from you. I can make it stop. So that's litigation in a nutshell. We'll kind of flesh it out as we go on as necessary. The other side is tax transactions. I advise mostly corporations and mid-sized companies who want to do some kind of transaction, be it a merger, a spin-off, an acquisition, whatever it is, I would be brought in to advise on the best way to structure the transaction so it's not just compliant tax-wise, but it's also efficient. So you are paying the least amount of taxes because it's all statutes and codes. You know, proceeding under one section of the code could make all the versus another could make all the difference as far as savings up front and down the road for your entity.
And I think it's really important to take a pause for a moment here, because I think that the average person who's listening today, I wouldn't know this unless I'd gone to law school and taken tax law myself, although I don't know how much I remember. But anyway, that for the average person to understand that when you go and you file your taxes, there are things that you can do to change the outcome one way or the other, depending on how much you pay or how much you receive back as a refund, right?
Yes. That's tax planning. But that unfortunately starts January 1. It does not happen on April 15th. It's always April 15th when everyone comes in and has some brilliant idea of how to change the status quo. It's not going to work. It's tax. You know, the idea is that you avoid taxes. You come up with, it's something that corporations, I'll give you a good example. GE did not pay a dime of taxes last year. Everyone's talking about it. Obama's talking about it. GE is the biggest company we have on this planet. Didn't pay a dime of taxes. How do you think that happened? Tax planning from day one. Every single transaction was looked at by people like myself to make sure that by December 31st, there will be no taxes due to the government. It works. GE is an example. So
if you know the rules, you know, folks are upset about the GE thing, I know. And perhaps in a sense they're being upset is about first not necessarily understanding that GE actually did play by the rules.
100%.
And then
100% play by the rule.
Okay, so then the issue might be then with the rules, if people are concerned about the fact that GE didn't pay taxes. But what I'm hearing from you then is that really they were playing by the rules.
They were playing by the rules, and you can play by the rules and reduce your tax hit just like they did. You might not be able to go for broke and get zero like they did, but you can significantly affect that bill that you pay April 15th or increase that refund that you get April 15th. And there are different ways to do it. As an individual working a 9-to-5, I got to tell you, there's really not much you can do. But if you're a business owner, a small business owner, you have Schedule C income, or you are, you know, once you're a business entity, the opportunities to take advantage of the tax code are there. They are there.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that as an individual working a 9-to-5, there's nothing for you, but I'm saying there's less room there, less room.
Right. And then one thing that you've said that sounds really important then is that the journey begins on January 1st. Don't wait until April 15th to talk about what happened last year. People can start today, of course, for next year.
Exactly.
But, you know, 2011 is already underway, and now is the time to optimize for next year's filing.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
That's my point.
Very nice. Well, we're going to get in the two major areas, I guess, then, that we will be addressing today. One is bankruptcy and the ins and outs of bankruptcy. And then if folks have tax questions during the show, you can call in. The number is 818-532-9789. Now listen very carefully to this. It's really important. When you call that number, 818-532-9789, all that does is that it shows me that there's a caller on the line. I have a switchboard here, and that shows up. If you want to be heard on the show, if you want to ask a question directly to my guest, then you press number 1. But it's really important that you don't press number 1 if you don't want to be on the air, because if you do press number 1, a little hand goes up. I have an icon of a little hand that goes up, and it says to me, I'm here, I want to be on the show, and I will come to you. And I will put you on the air. So make sure that you want to be on the air. And if you want to be on the air, hit that number 1. Otherwise, you know, you're free to call in to listen to the show. But if you want to call in to be on the show, call the number 818-532-9789 and press number 1. before we move on, actually, Uzoma, I wanted to ask, how do people reach you?
Best way to reach me, my number, 212-312-7214. I'm always reachable by that number, so I could give you all the myriad ways to reach me, but once you call that number, you'll find me.
Okay. And then what about folks who are just kind of curious and want to explore a little before talking with you, website?
My website is www.l, it's Law Eze, okay? So that's L-A-W-E-Z-E. My name is Uzoma Eze, so Law Eze, www.l-a-w-e-z-e.com.
Okay, fantastic. And for those of you who are joining into the chat room, you will see that that link is up there. I'm going to ask the chairman of the chat room to jot that down so that later on in the show it can come up again, so that those of you who are listening live to the show and are online and in the chat room can get that information. And we will repeat the information later on in the show so that you can be sure to visit Uzoma's website at some point when you're ready to start exploring, or use the phone number. And can you give us the phone number one more time, please?
212-312-7214.
Excellent. Okay. We're going to get started. And, you know, I did receive a couple of emails before the show that I think we can use to start off with. And here is one somebody wrote in, and I guess this is a great way to start, talking about the ramifications of bankruptcy in New York State. So I know that's a really big topic, but we could start talking about the ramifications, or we could start sort of chronologically talking about how a person comes to decide that they need to file for bankruptcy. Why don't we do that? Why don't we start with, when should a person start thinking, bankruptcy?
Well, the first thing that's the major misconception about bankruptcy law is insolvency. Insolvency is an accounting term. It simply means that you have more liabilities than assets. Bringing that further close to English, you have more debt than income. And some people actually think that for bankruptcy to be successful, for you to qualify, you have to be able to show that you are insolvent, as in the red. That is not true. There is nothing in the bankruptcy code that says you have to be insolvent. In fact, I will tell you that as of 2004, there was no requirement whatsoever. You could just go to court and file a bankruptcy if you just didn't feel like paying your landlord, okay?
What?
If you got pissed at one particular... Yeah, honestly, if you really didn't... Not your landlord is a bad example, okay? Let's say you have a particular creditor who has offended you and you don't want to pay him.
Okay.
And you owe him $3,000, you could go and file a bankruptcy and be free of it. Now, the Bush administration did some changes to the code, and now you actually have a hurdle to scale in order to qualify. What I'm saying is prior to 2005, there really wasn't a hurdle. If you were willing to declare bankruptcy, you would declare it and move on, and it would work. But the Bush administration put one hurdle there. It's still not an insolvency test. It's got nothing to do whether you are solvent or not. But it is a test, and it's called a means test, and we'll get there. It's very complicated. We'll get there in pieces. But the important thing to know is there is no hard and fast requirement that you be insolvent. Other requirements that tend to test just kind of how much of a financial difficulty are you in, but there is nothing that says you have to be insolvent.
So you're going to have a test that demonstrates how difficult your financial situation is, but then there is, like you're saying, there's no requirement that you be so financially difficult or in such financial difficulty or in what a different kind of financial difficulty. They just require you to establish what your means are.
Yes, you know, like I said, prior to what's called the BAP CPA, that's what the new law that the Bush administration put through in 2005, you didn't have to explain anything to anyone. If you were willing to throw yourself at the mercy of the court and say, hey, I want to file, you got it. That's it. Just file it. You're done. It wasn't a matter of how much money you had. It was just a matter of you don't feel like paying these debts, or you honestly don't think you can pay these debts, so you would file it. Well, what the BAP CPA did was they created this concept called the means test, and that's what confuses a lot of people today and makes them think that it is an insolvency requirement. It's still not an insolvency requirement. Nowhere in it does it say that you have to have more debt or more obligations than you have assets or income. No. What it does say is this. If you are in New York, okay, it's 50 states, all right? Each state has its own numbers. So if you're in New York and you're single, right? No kids, no wife, no husband, nothing. You're just a single person in New York.
Like me.
You have to earn less than 42,000. The number changes all the time. I think it's 42,000 now. You have to earn less than $42,000 in take-home pay in order to qualify for a bankruptcy.
So this is after taxes.
It has nothing
taxes.
To do with the debt. Huh?
So 42,000 after taxes.
Well, it gets a little bit more complicated. So
uh-oh.
Let me take it one at a time. $42,000 for a single person in New York. You have to earn, you have to have take-home pay of less than that, take-home, right?
Okay.
Now, when you say take-home, of course, take-home means after tax. But then that means test also has a whole slew of exceptions, deductions, exemptions from that from your gross income to get to this means test net income. So it's not the net income that you know. It's very different. It lets you subtract things like if you've got a lease on your car, you can subtract that. Your rent, you subtract that. Your food, you subtract that. Charitable contributions up to 15% of your gross, you subtract. Yeah, 15%. I've actually taken people to bankruptcy who were Christians and who were tithing, and they were giving something like $1,600 a month to the church.
Right.
And you would think, no way, this person is claiming bankruptcy and they're going to go to the bankruptcy court and straight-faced say to the trustee, look, you know, we're broke, but we give away $1,600 a month. And you're thinking he's going to throw the book at you, and he goes, no, the law says that you are allowed to do that, so you can't. So what I'm saying is that the means test is easily the most complicated aspect of filing for bankruptcy these days. In fact, it is the most complicated aspect. A lot of attorneys have left the business because of the means test. It's really complicated. It can get you in trouble as an attorney.
Okay.
But so it doesn't lend itself to me explaining it to you because I couldn't explain it to other bankruptcy attorneys. Let's put it that way. Yeah, but what I can tell you is that it is the only hurdle that's out there. And if you make substantial income, then you probably need to be talking to an attorney who understands the means test and is not afraid of it.
Okay.
I will tell you that as of last month, I got a discharge for a man, a single man living in Long Island who made $119,000.
Right.
That's to show you that $42,000 number I told you, it can be very illusory. People come to me and say, oh, I make $65,000. I don't qualify. I know about the means test. Oh, I make $70,000. I don't qualify. And I always laugh and I say, you know, I just filed for somebody who makes $119,000
okay.
and they qualify. So you don't know. My job is to know. My job is to look at your particular circumstances and determine whether you qualify or not.
Right. Okay. So then whether a person qualifies is going to be a very individual factor depending on the specifics of their situation and how you look at their situation in comparison to that very complicated means test. But what's important that folks understand is that there is this means test and then you understand from state to state that what numbers must happen in order for you to qualify to file for bankruptcy will change from state to state. So if you are listening from somewhere else in the United States and you're looking for an attorney, you're going to need to make sure that that attorney understands how to do this means test you know, what the numbers are that are relevant for you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thanks.
So we talked a bit about in the beginning, there's this idea of when it is that a person might want to file for bankruptcy and that now you've got this means test. But still, I think that folks who are actually feeling themselves to be teetering on the edge still have a barrier in that for all of my life anyway, I was told and under no uncertain terms do you file for bankruptcy unless it's the absolute, absolute last resort. But I seem to be hearing something different from you.
Yes, you are. I unfortunately assume I don't know what your readership or your listenership is as far as ethnic and racial breakdown and what communities your radio show reaches. We didn't discuss that. We probably should have. but I find that it's usually the black community, especially the African-American community that comes to me and is, you know, tailed between their legs, ashamed and trying to explain away how they're not losers because they're coming to see me. And I always have to stop them and say, you know, you don't owe me that explanation. You don't owe it to the court. You don't owe it to anybody. There is nothing to be ashamed of here. Other people are strategically using bankruptcies to build their futures. You know, one of the things that I, the idea that I find really interesting in bankruptcy is a lot of people, for instance, will invest in an idea, a business idea, and it doesn't work out, so they file a bankruptcy. Okay, they file a bankruptcy, they get rid of all the debt that they acquired to do this business idea. But guess what they took with them? The mountains, the heaps and heaps of intellectual property and knowledge that one gains from trying an enterprise and failing at an enterprise. You and I know from what we do that there is a mass of information that you gather from taking on any endeavor in life, especially a professional one. Now, you file a bankruptcy, you get rid of the debt that you used to learn that. Now, you take those ideas and you take them to a different scenario and build on that idea again, and you have a better chance of success a second time because you've made your mistakes, essentially on OPM.
OPM being other people's money.
Other people's money. Debt, right?
Right, right.
And now you go and you do your adventure again, sans bad idea, and you win. I think it was the CEO of Domino's Pizza who's reputed to have filed a bankruptcy, I think it was 6 times.
Wow.
Yeah, now I think the guy owns half of Florida. You need to check those facts. There is such a pizza CEO, a pizza magnate who made his money after several bankruptcy filings. So the stigma there is really something that someone has gone and gotten out into the common consciousness that it's just not true. I'm not for filing bankruptcies just to be filing it, but I've never met anyone who wanted to file a bankruptcy just to be filing it. The fact that you're considering it makes it an intelligent conversation. The fact that it even crossed your mind makes it one that you should discuss with someone.
But what you're saying then is really communities that have a history of viewing bankruptcy as being, you know, the last thing that you want to do and something to be ashamed of might actually be tying at least one hand behind their back in terms of increasing their financial acumen, their business acumen, and their success in business by discounting bankruptcy as a viable option.
Tying two hands and their right foot is ridiculous. I've heard people say to me, hey, I don't want to ruin my credit. And I'm looking at your credit. It's in the 400. It's 300 and change. And
it's already
so
ruined.
What you have is,
it's already ruined, basically.
Exactly. It is ruined beyond ruined, okay? Now look at it this way. And this is a client file that I'm working with right now. He has over $120,000 in unsecured debt. By that, I mean credit cards. He makes $110,000, $116,000 a year. He hasn't made any payments on any of these credit cards in the past year. They're all suing him. They've all gotten judgments. They are levying his accounts and garnishing his paycheck. And he comes to me and says, Mr. Ezra, I really don't want to file a bankruptcy because, you know, I'm just really ashamed and I feel like I'm copping out, I'm a loser, and I think it's going to destroy my credit. And I said, wait a minute, what do you think your credit looks like right now? Your credit is the worst kind of credit anyone can have. There's not even a rating for your kind of credit. It's so bad. But add to the fact that you still owe $120,000 and your credit will not clear up until you pay it off. Now look at the bankruptcy option. I filed a bankruptcy. The 120 vanishes into thin air, gone forever, never coming back at you. And you still have bad credit. So assuming your credit remained the same, what would you rather be? Owe 120 and have the worst credit, or not owe 120 and have the worst credit? What, just at as a threshold idea. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So you're actually kind of misinformed to think that you're worse off as a brand consultant. But here's the reality then. You put yourself in the shoes of a banker who's trying to lend, or someone who wants to loan, you know, lend money, or is thinking of lending money. Who would you lend to? Buddy before bankruptcy, owing $120,000 with the worst credit, or him after bankruptcy, still now owing zero, but still with that bad credit? Do you see what I'm saying? Is that one person has bad credit plus the complete and utter inability to pay. His paycheck is garnished. His bank account is levied. His house is leaned. So he's got no cash flow to pay any creditor. After the filing, all of a sudden, now guess what? He still works for the big company he used to work for. He still makes $116,000 a year, except now he doesn't have an obligation to fork over $5,000 every month just to stay above water.
Wow.
Which one would you lend money to?
Wow. Well, you know,
so it's kind of a very common misconception. Oh, my God, if I find that my credit will be ruined, and I go, the fact that you're even considering talking to me, chances are your credit's in a bad place. And I can, what I'm going to do will not make it worse. It would only make it better.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that's a huge thing to think about, because even hearing you talk about it, I could feel, you know, a sense of relief that a person might have where they've got this huge debt hanging over their head. They're concerned about their credit, and to hear that, well, you know, your credit's not going to change. It's already really bad, but you can be rid of this debt and not have that hanging over your head. You know, that's a potential source of great relief. And I'd like us to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to take a break and come back and talk a bit more about what precisely it means for your debt to be wiped away. I mean, how is it that corporations that lend money aren't totally up in arms about the fact that they could just totally lose all of this money that they had lent to you in the bankruptcy process? So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that. We're going to hear again from Mark Taylor, and this is a piece from his album called Quiet Land. It's called Kennebrew's Dance. And I'm very happy to be playing it because I know Kennebrew. Kennebrew is Mark Taylor's daughter. She's a wonderfully talented actress and a beautiful young woman. And so I'm happy to play for you this piece. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
right. Everyone, hi. Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining the show, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. And if you should know, Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. In mediation, you decide what fair is. You get to be your own judge. Settle your issues out of court. Contact me at info@123untangled.com or visit my website, www.123untangled.com, to learn more about my practice and what mediation can do for you and your family. You have just been listening to Mark Taylor. He's a French horn player and a jazz musician and composer, actually. And the piece that you were listening to is called Kennebrew's Dance, and it was named for his daughter, Kennebrew Taylor. It's a wonderful album called Quiet Land, and I hope you're enjoying the music as well as the show. On the show today, I have my guest, Uzoma Eze, who is an attorney and also a CPA, although his focus now is on practicing bankruptcy and tax law. And we are talking today about the ramifications of filing for bankruptcy and then also talking about whatever tax questions might be out there. You know, in the United States, tomorrow is the deadline to file federal and state income taxes. So there might be those of you who are down to the wire at the last minute who have some last-minute questions. And then we can also talk a bit, if we have time, about how to plan to maximize your tax situation next year. So, Uzoma, thank you so much. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Patabile.
Wonderful. Listen, before we started with the break, before we went to the break, I said that we would come back and talk about what it means for your debt to be wiped out. And, you know, what does it mean to the creditors for your debt to be wiped out? But before we get there, I actually have a caller who I'm hoping actually intends to be on the air. So this is someone in the 917 area code, and you can remain anonymous, of course. I want everybody who's calling in to understand that. You do not need to give your name, and I will only refer to you by your area code. So if you're in the 917 area and you have called in, this might be you. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Batavila. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And I'm hoping you have a question for my guest, Mr. Eze.
I do indeed. I appreciated the clarification about the means test. My question goes past the means test and is about what type of debts can be included in a bankruptcy filing. It was my understanding that the same Bush legislation made it difficult to include student loans in bankruptcy filings. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. You're safe for assuming that student loans are not dischargeable. There is such a thing called a hardship exemption, but that's very hard to prove. So for all practical purposes, you will not be discharging your student loans in a bankruptcy.
I may, in fact, have a hardship exemption, but I appreciate that. What do you need to bring when you see an attorney to get the ball rolling, so to speak?
For the most part, you need to bring proofs of income. I think that's the big one. Your pay stubs for the past 6 months, bank statements for, say, the past year. I think with that, you can have a conversation with your attorney as to whether this is a go forward or not. And, of course, okay, put it this way. Pay stubs 6 months, bank statements 1 year, and go to freecreditreport.com and run a credit report. Only because that's one easy way to know what all your credit relationships are. As opposed to ask you to go in your stash and bring out all your credit card statements, I could just ask you to go to freecreditreport.com, print that, and that will tell me everybody who claims you owe them money, the ones you know and the ones you don't know.
Okay.
And the ones you don't know might be the most important ones.
There you go.
All right. So those are the three things that I'm hearing here. It's your one-year bank statements, 6 months of pay stubs, and your credit report.
Yes.
say?
I mean, your attorney is going to tell you other things to bring as the relationship progresses, but you sound to me like somebody who wants to do a consult. And I think those, if you brought those three things to me, I'd be able to make a very quick determination as to whether to go forward, how to go forward. And then after we get through that, then we go into the other things, your tax returns, your credit counseling. It's document intensive, yes, but I think with those three things, you can have that conversation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good. Did
You're
you
welcome.
Have any other? Thank you. Did you have any other questions?
I did, because I do think I have a hardship exemption. I actually lost everything in Hurricane Katrina, and one of the debts that I had is to the SBA, not because I'm a small business, but because I got a disaster loan, and I wondered where do you know student loans, government loans, those kinds of things like. How does that work?
Well, student loans and government loans are two very, very different things. A loan is a loan is a loan is a loan, period, and will get discharged in a bankruptcy. There are very few hard core exceptions. They're very clear. Student loans are student loans. You said SBA loan?
Yes.
SBA loan is just a loan. It's a loan like any other loan. Do you see what I mean? Your student loan, you can discharge. Your SBA loan is the same thing as Citibank giving you a loan.
Now, let me see if I can get clarification here. To the caller, the SBA loan you're talking about, is that the kind of loan that you got because of what happened with Hurricane Katrina? And I'm very sorry, first of all,
yeah.
Let me say that has got to be awful to be still recovering from that kind of a devastating loss.
Yes. It was a major sort of occurrence, and then after that, I was unemployed for a period. So what kind of happened was, having received this disaster loan, I was then not in a position to be able to continue to repay it. So going back to what Mr. Ize said at the beginning, kind of strategically, I'm thinking at my age, I could continue to try and pay down debt, or I could put myself in a position where I could actually recover. So that's why I was thinking about finding out more about bankruptcy and whether or not it was appropriate for me.
And do you mind saying how old you are?
I'm 40.
Okay. So you've got a 40-year-old who is trying to make a decision between filing bankruptcy or continuing to try to pay down a debt, and it sounds like it's an SBA loan that happened as a result of losing everything in Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
And actually, what's your name again? I missed it.
Well, actually,
she didn't
give her name, and we're keeping
people
anonymous.
She didn't. I'm sorry. Oh, we're not supposed to give names. I didn't mean to ask you that. Okay. Here's what I just wanted to make sure I'm referring to you. I think the point I was trying to make is student loan. If you think there's a case for discharging that, that's very high-level work. You definitely need to sit down with a bankruptcy attorney who does that kind of work and go through, you know, step-by-step why you would get a discharge versus other people who have failed. It's kind of a fact-intensive. Your hardship has to be the kind that the court have recognized in the past and said, yes, this one will let go. I will tell you that it's rare. That's one thing, but I think the other thing you're talking about is an SBA loan. That's not the loan that you're – when you say SBA loan, you're not referring to the student loan.
No. Prior to Katrina, I was a productive citizen paying my student loan. Then that happened, and it became very difficult because of consequent life events for me to pay my student loans, this new disaster loan – and the ongoing kind of day-to-day expense of just being an adult. So those are actually three different categories of things, the student loan, then the SBA loans, and those things. And I just wanted to find out, you know, what kinds of things I could include and what wouldn't be included if I considered bankruptcy.
Yeah, generally what wouldn't be included would be specifically, and, you know, there have been cases where people have come to me and thought they had student loans and they didn't. You know, it's not – we're talking student loan from, you know, actually taken out clearly expressly to go to college, okay, or to get an education. Student loans generally are bad news. You can't discharge them, but the presumption in bankruptcy is that most debts are dischargeable. Even taxes are dischargeable. They got to meet certain criteria, but taxes actually are dischargeable. This is a fact that a lot of people don't know. So I'll tell you what's not dischargeable. Student loan and domestic support obligations. If you went through a divorce and as part of the stipulation was that you will pay your spouse X $300 a month, $400 a month, those kinds of obligations, of course, child support, you can't discharge those. But as far as debts go, as you borrowed money from someone, the presumption generally is, I guess what I'm saying, it is more likely dischargeable than non-dischargeable. The non-dischargeable classes, I pretty much just told you.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, caller, for calling in. Those were excellent questions and really got us into answering some questions that I actually had and giving me answers to things that I hadn't thought to ask. So this is really wonderful. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks.
All right. So we learned a little bit about, for example, taxes being dischargeable. I had not known that you could discharge your taxes in bankruptcy. Let me ask this question about, you know, going back to the issue of student loans, just to clarify again. So some people, when they go, especially if it's in graduate school, they go to take out loans for school, they are not able to borrow enough from Sallie Mae, for example, the large government lender for educational loans. But they go then to private companies and take out private loans for their education. Are those considered education loans or are those considered dischargeable?
They are, and those are education loans. Well, let me give you the example I was talking about. I once had a medical student who had a brilliant stroke of genius, or whatever you want to call it, depending on what side of the fence you are. I'm clearly partisan. I'm a bankruptcy attorney. I am for the debtors. Let's make that very clear. If there are any creditors online, I'm not on your side. But the fact is she came and she told me an interesting story. You know, she'd borrowed for medical school, but, you know, wherever possible, she used her credit card, you know. And she had amassed a significant amount of debt on the credit card, which she essentially used as, you know, I use the student loans for those loans that I absolutely must get as a student loan, but everything else she charged on a credit card. So
wow.
Be it instead of taking out a loan to pay for the housing, she'd pay for it on her credit card. I guess certain, like, she essentially came up with a $75,000 credit card bill that for all intents and purposes looked like it was mostly school expenses. And suffice it to say, they did not qualify as student loans, so they got discharged.
Wow.
So, you know, if you really look at it very technically, you could say, wow, those are basically student loans. They were loaned to her to use for her education, very clearly, but they were on a credit card. You know, whatever that bank was, they gave them that credit card, didn't cross his T's and dot his I's enough to make sure that people would not get smart and use the, and put the debt on a credit card. So, you know, you come out of medical school and you would have come out with $150,000 worth of debt, and somehow you end up with $75,000. That's a huge win, and that's what this person did. So, and that's what I was saying. And with taxes, I'm not saying, I know everyone who hears this is going to call my office. It's actually very good marketing, but also bad for my receptionist because the phone lines will explode. But the important thing is that people have this impression that taxes are one of those sacrosanct, like student loans, you know, you can't discharge them. That's not true. There are certain criteria, certain things that you look at in a particular tax debt to see whether they're dischargeable. One of them is the age of the debt. You can't discharge, you know, you can't, today is what, April 17th. You come to me, you say, wow, I just did my taxes, I owe $30,000, I got to get the government $30,000 tomorrow. Mr. Ezra, let's file a bankruptcy and get rid of that. Can't do that. It's too fresh. So one of the main things about tax debt, if it's income taxes, it can't be fresh. It's got to be 3 years old. which actually is a good thing because a lot of people owe taxes from way back when and they've been trying to survive and get passed on them. And just the mere fact that those tax debts are old and they're from your past, we could include them in a bankruptcy and get rid of them.
Okay.
Again, I have to be careful not to oversimplify, but what I want to do is make sure that these common misconceptions out there, we just want to poke a hole in them.
And that's really important for folks to know, that you're giving general information about the rules. Whether and
the
how
rules,
they
exactly.
apply to any specific person is not a guarantee.
Exactly. This is as general as you can make a very specific, fact-intensive area of law.
Okay. So we are talking with Attorney Uzoma Eze about bankruptcy law and a little bit of tax thrown in. Be sure to call in if you have questions, 818-532-9789. That's 818-532-9789. And if you are listening over the internet, you can log into the chat room. I encourage you to do that. I have the chairman of the chat room in there right now who can help you to formulate your question if you need that and make sure that the question comes in so that Mr. Eze can address your question. You know, we had a break just a short time ago, and before I took the call, I said that we were going to talk a bit about what it means for your debt to be wiped out. And you just told the story about this medical student who put a large amount of the debt onto a credit card and then was able to get that wiped out. And I was thinking, well, what kind of behavior might that be encouraging, and why would the tax code or the bankruptcy code allow for that kind of thing? I mean, is that really what happens, that a person can be strategic and think ahead and say, you know what, I have no intention of ever paying off this debt. I'm going to borrow this money and do it in such a way that it can be wiped out in bankruptcy.
Well, the first thing to understand about the bankruptcy code is it wasn't written for the banks. It wasn't written for the creditor. It was a means of relieving citizens. I mean, think about the history of this country. A lot of those guys who came over here to found this country, at least one of them, and I forget his name now, was in debtor prison until he got on a boat and came here. I don't think it was John Hancock. It was one of those names. Anyway, The fact is, this is one of the things that really hurt people didn't like about the old world, England specifically. If you owed debt, you could go to jail and rot away in jail until you paid the debt. And that made no sense, because how are you going to pay the debt when you're in jail doing nothing? Let the
Good
man
question.
Out, let the person out on the street. Maybe they'll put together one or two ideas or do one or two things and create wealth, employ people, and maybe pay off the debt. But the idea came that it makes more sense to give someone a fresh start than it does to ensure the creditor's right to collect. So you got to think about how the code was first conceptualized. It wasn't about making sure that creditors get their money. Creditors had ways of getting their money. It was making sure that American citizens did not go to jail or spend the rest of their lives kind of on the hamster wheel and not really being fully functioning members of society, productive members of society. We needed to give them relief. So the bankruptcy code is actually relief. So the idea is it full-on favors the idea that a person should be able to walk away from debt that they cannot pay. It doesn't matter where you got it from. Unless, of course, the banks can. And the banks always, they do come to court. So the creditors come to court and they try to prove that as of the time you took their debt, you knew you could never pay back. Yeah. If they can prove that, you lose your bankruptcy case. But that is rare because first of all, proven intent is a very difficult thing. And the fact is, my medical student did not think that she was going to cheat the system. It was just a matter of, you know, she was being very, and this is a law, this is legal planning, this is what you should always do. The fact is, she knew what her rights were. She knew what kind of debts were dischargeable and what were not. She fully intended to pay them. She had no way of knowing that when she got out of medical school, a residency would pay her less than minimum wage and that she wouldn't be able to find a fault. These things no one could have known. She bought a house. Okay, I didn't tell you that part. She had bought a house. And the house became a victim of the subprime meltdown. So now she's carrying a $3,000 note on a piece of property that's not even worth $1,000 a month. So a lot of other things have happened in our life that have made it such that this young doctor who was supposed to be able to come back and pay all her debts all of a sudden couldn't. So what I'm trying to make clear is it's not okay. I'm not advocating going out and taking debt with this express purpose of trying to charge you in a bankruptcy. If anyone can prove that, you're in trouble. But I submit to you that 99% of the time, this is not what people are trying to do.
Okay. So there you had what seemed to be a coincidence of unfortunate events, particularly for the student, where you know she comes out thinking, I'm going to be a doctor. I mean, you know, doctors are reputed to make plenty of money and be able to pay off their debts, but she happened to come out in a time where it turned out that she wasn't going to have the income that she thought she was going to have in order to be able to pay these debts. So she goes to court. She hires you. You go to court to have these debts discharged. What happens in terms of the creditors where the debt is being discharged? I mean, why isn't that they aren't riding out in the streets because people can come into bankruptcy court and have their debts wiped out?
It's a very calculated decision on their part. They've been able to convince you and most of your listeners that bankruptcy is a horrible thing to do and something you should stay away from at all costs. But I will tell you this, that, and this is another one of the things that's going to make my commenting on this show slightly difficult for me, but I'll make these general statements, but it's very clear that this is not legal advice, and you can't turn around and say, hey, you know, I didn't give you legal advice as to your situation. I'm making an observation from my position as a bankruptcy attorney, what I've seen. 2-3 months after a filing, you're getting solicitations from banks asking you to come take a credit card. Did you know that?
What?
Yeah, my clients come to me 3 months after the filing.
These same banks.
I don't mean a different bank. These same banks are coming and soliciting them. You have to understand that the credit industry, these people, I don't know if you guys have seen this show, Maxed Out. I saw it on Netflix. It's a documentary, and it actually features the woman who Obama has set up as his consumer protection czar. What's her name now? I forget, but she was on the show, and she was the one explaining how much money the banks make from bad accounts. So you consider yourself bad credit, and you're honored that the banks actually deal with you. No, you are a huge, huge revenue pool, huge income pool. The rich people who can actually afford to pay for stuff, the banks don't like them because they charge up $30,000 and they pay it off in 29 days. You go to the store, you buy you spend an hour and a half looking for that perfect shoe that's on sale, and you find it on sale 50% off, and you pay $39 for it. And what do? You charge it. And, of course, once you charge it, you've just paid $45 for that shoe, but that doesn't even cross your mind because you got a sale. And then, of course, you make a mistake and you don't pay in full by the end of the month, or you make a late payment. And now $25 comes in on that shoe. By the time all is said and done, that $39 shoe cost you $102, but you don't see it. It's all hidden in the details. It's a very lucrative business for the credit card companies. They can't risk going out and screaming about it, because if they do, people will actually get educated about it, because, you know, it's like what we do in court. You don't want to ask someone questions or depose them too much, lest they say that thing that kills your case, because you got to be careful what questions you ask. You might get the answer that buries you. So if you push consumers in that direction, they might say, wait a minute, why are you being so draconian about this? And then they'll do some research and find out that, oh, my gosh, I've been had. So, no, there is nothing. I mean, in all my time filing bankruptcy, it's been 3 years now that I've exclusively practiced as a bankruptcy lawyer. I have had one bank come after me, come after my client and say, no, this is non-dischargeable. And I can tell you that as of right now, he came in claiming that $10,000 was non-dischargeable, and now he's begging me to give him $2,500 so he can walk away with his tail between his legs.
Oh, wow.
That's true. He's asking me to beg my client to just give him $2,500. We've litigated this thing. We're ready for trial right now, and he realized he doesn't have a case. So,
banks. Well, let's make sure that we're clear about why that is, what the incentive is. They started out with $10,000. Now they're willing to settle for $2,500 because if you go to trial and they don't have a case, it could be zero.
it will be zero, and I'll make a motion for attorney fees, which means he pays my attorney fees.
Ah.
The bankruptcy code gives my client the right to sue for attorney fees. So if we go to court and we win, he gets zero, and on top of that, I itemize my hourly billings, which are probably over $4,000 right now, and he has to pay that. So double whammy for him. So now he's saying, just give me something to take back to my bank. But that's just a side anecdote to speak. Doesn't go to to what we're talking about here. All I'm saying to you is the banks do not come. Why do they keep quiet? Because they absolutely have to. The bankruptcy code makes it a violation of a court order with very serious consequences if they ever try to contact you or do anything to you because you file a bankruptcy. From the minute you file a bankruptcy, all collection efforts, all phone calls, all emails, all mails, everything must end. And you have a fresh slate, and you can start all over again, and no one can talk about the past life that you lived. They can't even have that conversation with you. It's done. It's buried. So once the discharge happens, past is past. It can never come back up again.
Okay. So, again, just to make it clear, you were talking about how people who have filed will then find themselves having solicitations to take out more money. And something you said a little bit earlier actually ties into that. You said that a person is attractive to a bank if, even though they have bad credit, they don't owe anything.
Let me make that very clear. Yes, you're right. The two are completely connected, and I was going to try and connect them. Thank you for bringing that up. Look at it this way. Like I gave you the example. Prior to filing, you owe $100,000, and your credit is, for lack of a better word, terrible. Okay? But guess what? At $100,000 in bad credit, no one is going to give you enough money to buy a toothpick, okay, because you can't pay anything. Yes, you make $100,000, but you owe $100,000. You have horrible credit, and you need to pay like $3,500 a month just to make your interest payment. So you are horrible. And then, of course, some of those creditors have leaned or are about to lean on your bank accounts, your paycheck, and your house. So why would you loan to that person? Why would you lend to that person? Well, the person files a bankruptcy. Guess what happens once they file a bankruptcy? The other side of the balance sheet falls out. All the person has now is his $100,000 worth of income and no debt. So when you – and guess what? Here's the part I forgot to add the first time. When you file a bankruptcy, a Chapter 7 specifically, you cannot file again for another 8 years. What does that mean? That means that the person who loans money to you on day one of your new life as a brand new customer, first of all, they know they are guaranteed payments because you have the income but no longer the debt. Okay, that $100,000 vanished, and now they've just given you $5,000. So they know you can handle $5,000 because that's the only debt you have on the books because a bankruptcy quashes all debt. The other thing they know is that you can't file again for 8 years. So they know they'll collect for at least another 8 years before you come up with this brainy idea of filing again. So do you see how, from our lenders, they're not going to go out and say this because the whole country will just run to the courts and run to me, and they'll be in real trouble. So they can't say it out loud to you. But the truth is, people think that life after bankruptcy is some kind of zombie, futuristic land where you're just wandering around and you can't get a job and you can't get credit and no one will talk to you because you're wearing a scarlet letter. No. It's absolute fabrication. It is designed to do what it already does very well, which is dissuade you, which is make you keep going back to the banks and redealing. Could you give me an extension, a break here, reduce my APR, give me extended payments, reduce my monthly payments, and all these things you're doing are just ka-ching. Because every time you say, okay, can you reduce my minimum payment from $400 a month to $200, of course they want to do that. Because now every time you pay, you're not even touching the interest. The interest is just multiplying at a ridiculous amount. So those options that are left open to you, go to a debt counseling agency, get a new job, work a new job, work overnight, drive a cab, I think I've gone too far. I've said what I want to say, and that's that.
I'm sort of memorized by this idea. And again, it's not to say that this is a guarantee of what might happen for any individual person who's listening. if they were to file for bankruptcy, it's not to say that every single person is now getting solicitations from the bank, but you make some very interesting points, and I actually want to dive a little bit deeper into one, which is about this the fact that you cannot file again for another 8 years if you have your debts discharged in bankruptcy, because I'm thinking, you know, it is unfortunate. Life happens, and people sometimes get unlucky twice. So if a person is in year five, let's say, after having filed for bankruptcy, and again they find themselves in a situation where they just cannot make their payments, you know, what happens then? We don't have debtor's prison. What does happen when you cannot file for bankruptcy and you find that you simply cannot pay your debt?
Well, the collection agencies will bug you day and night and call you all the time, and if they feel that they can get away with it, they'll sue you, and when they get a judgment, they'll try to either levy on your bank account, in which case I recommend you change back, or they'll try to garnish your paycheck, in which case, I don't know, that's kind of one that they do because they know you won't run away from your job, but the fact is, if I clean you up off of that $35,000 you've been carrying around you like a yoke for the past 7 years, I bet you'll be okay for another 8 years. I don't think you're going to go down that quickly in 8 years. It's really rare because you learn a lot from the experience.
Well,
what are the odds that you're going to get into that trouble again within the next, you know, 5 to 6 years? I think it's a possibility, but less a probability.
So it's not encouraging people to be irresponsible because once
exactly.
You've gone through bankruptcy the first time, the consequences, the potential consequences of finding yourself in that kind of financial situation again 4 or 5 years later are just that dire. You just don't.
Yeah. I don't know how you get there that quickly. You know, you shouldn't. I mean, things like medical, you know, life happens. You get sick and you go to the hospital, no health insurance. 3 days in there, you owe $45,000. It happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, I submit to you that if after filing a bankruptcy, you find yourself back in debt $45,000 to a hospital for saving your life, you'll see that debt a little differently and you'll figure out other ways to get around it. But I just don't see that being the consideration that makes you go, I mean, what are we saying here? Because you can't do it again for 8 years that you shouldn't do it this time, you know?
Okay.
So as a practical application, I don't think that's a consideration people should worry about when they're filing.
Okay.
You'll be fine. Once you clean this mess you have, chances are you'll be better the second time.
All right. Well, I'm going to take another little break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about what a person who is going through bankruptcy might find themselves having to give up, if anything. There was a question here about whether a person can keep their home. So what happens to the assets that you do have in bankruptcy? And we'll talk about that when we come back. I am talking with attorney Zoma Eze, who specializes in bankruptcy and tax law. And we're talking mainly about bankruptcy. But again, the phone lines are open. So if you'd like to call in, the number is 818-532-9789, and I'll be ready to take your calls after the break if you decide to call in, but we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be listening again to Mark Taylor. He is a jazz artist and composer who plays the French horn. The piece is called Oni, and it's from his album Circle Squared. Enjoy, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
folks, we're back on the air. It sounds as though we have been on the air. My microphone was supposed to have been muted so that I could take a call that was coming in, somebody who wants to call in with a question, and it sounds as though you were all privy to that. You know, listen, if it happens to the president, and it has happened to the president, to folks that work for the president, it can happen to anybody. So we are back here, and if you're just tuning in, this is Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. In mediation, you decide what fair is. Be your own judge. Settle your issues out of court. Contact me at info@123untangled.com or visit my website, www.123untangled.com, to learn more about my practice and what mediation can do for you and your family. You were listening to jazz French horn player Mark Taylor with a piece called Oni, and that is from his album called Circle Squared. And I believe his music is available on iTunes. If not, you can look it up at Amazon.com, or you can contact me, send me email at info@123untangled.com to hear more about his music. And it's really exciting, actually. I'm glad to be playing him today. The last piece that you will hear from him is actually a premiere. This is from an album that was just mastered last week, so it is brand new. They haven't even had the release party yet, and I'll tell you more about that when we are toward the end of the show. I also want to make sure that you remember Project Safe Surrender. This is Safe Surrender is an opportunity for folks who are in the New York City area who have see summonses and perhaps have bench warrants out for their arrest to come in voluntarily and have their cases heard by a judge at a church. And this is at the Antioch Baptist Church. And the Antioch Baptist Church is at 823 Green Avenue in Brooklyn. If you want more information about this, visit the website. That is at www.projectsafesurrender2011.org. And Project Safe Surrender 2011, it's all one word together. We'll try to get that link up in the chat room for those of you who are here live. And if you want more information, of course, you can go to the website. Remember that it is this coming weekend, this Friday and Saturday, April 22nd and 23rd, at the Antioch Baptist Church. Very important information right there. All right, we are on the air here with my guest, Zoma Eze, who is a tax and bankruptcy attorney who's answering our questions about those two issues. And Zoma, your mic is back on, and I'm welcoming you back to the show.
Thank you.
Great. Now, before we get into the question that I had before our last break, which is what actually happens to a person's assets in bankruptcy, it looks like we have a call, and this is from the 909 area code. Caller, you are on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a question.
Welcome.
Yes, somebody, I've taken the bar exam, and I want to apply to be admitted to the bar, but filed for bankruptcy. How does that affect my chances of being admitted to the bar?
You have finished law school, taken the bar, passed the bar, but haven't applied for admission?
Yes.
Well, first things first is there is a there's a non-discrimination provision clause within the bankruptcy code. Okay, you're not allowed to discriminate against a person because of their bankruptcy status. It's up there with race, sex, whatever. You just can't treat someone different because of their bankruptcy statute, a bankruptcy status. So it doesn't matter whether you're a lawyer or a law student or anything. It's just the reality. You're not no one's supposed to discriminate against you. It's federal law. That being said, some of the practical ramifications of your situation is you've just given the fitness committee one more thing to go, one more rabbit hole to go crawling down. I suppose it's highly likely they'll go crawling down that hole and come back and say, you know what, he's fine. The only reason why, if you had come to me, I would say, hold off until we finish applying, okay? Let's get the application done. Let's get the admission, and then we'll do it. Not because I think this is going to cost you your admission, but I think it could hold it up and create further investigations. You see what I mean?
I see, yes.
The funny story I heard, and this is completely unrelated to bankruptcy, well, I heard someone advising a client of mine, and this person actually worked for the federal government, saying, when you go to do your application for your clearance, et cetera, you don't want to be too quick to say that you don't smoke marijuana. Because if you say that, what that does is it makes the government's ears perk up, and they're like, most Americans have smoked marijuana. So if you say you haven't, then we're just going to investigate you more because you could be a liar.
That's cool. It was
a very interesting thing to hear coming from the federal government. And what I'm saying is certain answers to certain questions do not get you in trouble or not, but they could now take the application process and make it that much more difficult or that much more take that much more time to clear. So I'm afraid that this will hold up your process, but ultimately I think you'll be fine.
Oh, thank you so much. Glad to hear that.
Thank you, caller. Thank you for calling in. And that was a very good question, actually. Thank you for calling. Actually, I have a question that if I could follow up, we were talking specifically about getting a law license. Would you say that this is something that a person can expect across the board? Let's say a person wants to become licensed as a nurse or as a physician or in some other profession.
No. I would think that the only place where a bankruptcy filing could actually hurt you is in the context of you trying to be a certified financial advisor or something along those lines. If you're about to get a qualification as a certified financial counselor or some kind of financial thing, and part of your application is to say, hey, by the way, I just filed for a bankruptcy. There's no law out there, but I'm just guessing that's not going to fly.
Sure. But even
I've never had that happen to one of my clients, but I have a feeling that's going to be a problem. But short of that, no, bankruptcy, nursing, doctor, it's got nothing to do with anything at all. And the other thing that I should have stressed with the guy who just got off with us is that when you file a bankruptcy, it's public record, okay? And so if you apply for the bar, they're going to ask you to bring a copy of the petition. And they might actually go over the petition. And the problem is, when it's like everything that we do. We all try to be ethical and be correct, but if you were to take a tax return that you did 4 years ago and go over it with a fine-tooth comb, I bet you'll find somewhere where you made a mistake, probably inadvertent. But you see how that could call attention and get 100 questions off of something that was just a slip-up that would have gone into obscurity had no one actually looked at it very closely?
Right.
So I can see a situation where they would print off his bankruptcy petition and go over it page by page, line by line, and ask him a dozen questions. Why did you say this? Why did you say that? Why did you not say this? Why did you not bring this up? Oh, I forgot. Why would you forget a thing like that? Were you lying or did you honestly forget? I really did forget. But that's how that could complicate the process. But in answer to your question, Patabile, no. Bankruptcy filing, generally not something that you would have to worry about with your other jobs.
Okay. Very important to know. Listen,
I'll give you a good example. One more example, and then
sure.
I know we're almost out of time here, but this is an interesting one. I had someone call me. He was a federal government employee. He needed to get his clearance. You know how they have to get clearance to work these jobs?
Yes.
Department of Homeland Security, yeah, DHS. And he came to me, and he said, my clearance is coming up, and I owe all this money, and I have this property that's going into foreclosure. And I've been told that if I don't deal with this foreclosure, I would not get my clearance. And I said to them, well, the only way to deal with my foreclosure is to pay $300,000, and I don't have it. And the person doing my clearance asked me to go file a bankruptcy.
Wow.
So that was an interesting thing because you're thinking, my clearance will really be botched up by filing a bankruptcy. And here I am telling you that I filed a bankruptcy for a man who was a an employee at the Department of Homeland Security and whose clearance was about to be denied because of debts that he owed that he wasn't managing. So for most institutions, especially the ones that have any kind of common sense, bad debt is considered you not handling your business. Filing of a bankruptcy is actually considered you handling your business. And that is looked on more favorably than unresolved debt issues.
Which is exactly the opposite of conventional wisdom for many, many people.
Which is what I was trying to make the point of this conversation. Like I told you earlier, I always hear these things in my office, and I have to control myself because I don't want you to think that I'm an angry attorney. But I'm thinking to myself, who is feeding these people this nonsense? It is pure nonsense. And people live their lives thinking this stuff. Anyway, so yes, this is one of those good ones to know. It actually is a sign of you handling your financial business to file a bankruptcy. You are in better stead than the person who has unresolved financial issues. A bankruptcy is a full resolution, period, end of story. Move on.
Okay. Well, listen, we have another caller, and we're getting a lot of love from the 909 area code today. So it's somebody else from the 909 area code. Caller, you are on the air.
Hello, Tabby.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. This is Emmanuel. Listen, I have a question here. I'm a real estate broker, and oftentimes my customers come to me and ask me a question. Can I file, if I'm about to lose my house, can I file a bankruptcy without affecting my credit cards? In this case, what should I tell them?
Okay. I think you're going to – I think I understand the question, but you might need to repeat the last part of it. He's saying that as a real estate broker, you have clients who come to you who are about to lose their house, and they want to know if they file bankruptcy, how will it affect their credit cards?
Yes. Some of them want to file bankruptcy without including their credit card. Let's assume they have only one credit card and they want to maintain it. What would be the advice? Because generally when people go to the bankruptcy court, you have to list everything that you're owing.
Right. Interesting question. So, what's the answer?
Short answer, there's no getting around that. Bankruptcy is a shotgun approach. You pull out the shotgun and you blow it all away. It's done. You have to list everything you owe. People always say that to me, and they want to keep this one credit card. That's the other side. So you're asking me what's the downside to a bankruptcy? Yes, you got to give it all up. You got to list every single debt. Theoretically, debts that you owe your family members, whatever. You can always go back and pay people if you want to. That's voluntary, but you must list them in the bankruptcy that you owe them. And when you do that listing, the credit cards will come back in and they'll cancel all your credit cards.
So even
that's
if it's a credit
ground zero.
Right. So even if it's a credit card where you have been keeping up with the payments, let's say it's a great credit card, you've had it for many, many years, and you have an excellent percentage rate on it, you still have to give up that card.
It's gone. You don't have to give it up. You will include it in the filing, and when you do that, it gets wiped out. Whatever balance you have on it gets wiped out, and they will stop extending credit to you.
Okay. Well, another follow-up question here, though. Would the bankruptcy judge allow you or ask the mortgage company to modify your loan if you want to keep the property?
Well, there's three kinds of bankruptcies. There's a Chapter 7, a Chapter 11, and a Chapter 13. In a Chapter 7, you lose everything. Whatever assets you have, if they go – okay, put it this way. There are exemption laws, okay? So, for instance, if you own a house, if you have less than $50,000 worth of equity in it, which is most people these days thanks to the current financial market – you can get to keep the house. And that's how I'm able to keep a lot of my clients' houses in Chapter 7 is I do an appraisal. I compare the appraisal number to the mortgage statement. The person is either underwater, no equity in the house, or barely breaking even. I can save the house. Or the person has $50,000 or less equity in the house. I can save the house. But if you have $200,000, $100,000 worth of equity in the house, in a Chapter 7, you give it away. That being said, that's Chapter 7. That's just one filing. The next filing is a Chapter 13. That one is actually the codification of modification. The idea of a 13 is to modify your debts, is to bring them all together, figure out how much you can pay, and then allocate what you can pay to the creditors around. In a situation like that, you can think about it as a forced loan modification. It's not the loan modification that the banks are selling right now, but the court, with its own tools, will look for ways to break down the debt for this person. There might be pieces that get taken away and removed, reduced. We essentially keep moving the numbers until we get to a number by which the person can continue to own their house, and the banks can get something for their trouble. So, but the Chapter 13 is really complicated, and not something I can get into detail here. But as far as saving your house and keeping your house in a bankruptcy and being able to modify its terms, that's done in a bankruptcy. That's specifically done in a Chapter 13.
Okay. Now, what if this is an investment property? What do you do in that case?
Investment properties. It's not about what kind of property it is in a Chapter 13. It's about how much you can pay.
So it doesn't
really,
matter
it
what
comes
kind
down to what we do is we determine what your disposable monthly income is, and we determine just how much. The answer may be that you are carrying too much debt, and there's no way you could possibly support payments on that investment property. In which case, the banks you'd have to give the property back to the banks and let them go away with it. But if there is any means, if you can prove to a judge through a Chapter 13 plan that given this break here, this move here, this forgiveness here, I can now be able to manage my finances and pay it all off for the next 5 years, it will get confirmed, and you get to keep everything.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much, caller.
Okay.
I really appreciated you calling in. And this was Emmanuel?
Yes.
Well, it's wonderful to hear from you, and I'm glad to know that you're listening to the show, and I hope that you found these answers to be helpful to you.
Yes.
Great.
Very much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I need to move on to our next part of the topic, which actually piggybacks off of what we've just been talking about. If you have further questions, please feel free to contact Mr. Eze, perhaps sending him an email. If he's willing and it's not taking up too much of his time, you might be able to get some more information that way. Do you mind giving us your information again, Uzoma?
Yes, my phone number is 212-312-7214. My website is www.laweze.com.
Awesome. Okay, very wonderful. And this is great. I'm so glad that this question came in, because it leads us really nicely into what I said we would be talking about after the break, which has to do with what does happen to your assets in bankruptcy. You started to talk about how there are two different kinds of filings for individuals. There's the Chapter 7 and then Chapter 13, and different things happen in Chapter 7 versus Chapter 13. So could you start out by explaining the difference between those two?
A Chapter 7 is what's called a liquidation. The idea here is you walk away, okay? You bring all your assets and you put them on the table and you hand them over to the court. And the court just takes your assets, squeezes out as much juice as they can, and pay whatever comes out of it to your creditors. You're free. They never contact you again, okay? That's the fundamental way to look at a Chapter 7.
But let me jump in for just a second here, because you've said something that's really important and kind of profound, which is that all of your assets are put on the table and then they get divvied up amongst your creditors and that settles it. But the question is, for me, what constitutes all? I mean, is it really?
Well, that's where I was going with that.
Okay.
See, what we do is, so, and I was giving you the very fundamental kind of hardcore way to look at it so you get it, right? So you take all these assets, you put them on a table, and then you walk away. But here's the catch. There are things called exemptions in bankruptcy laws, okay? So it starts with this. There is an exemption for every class of asset that a person could possibly own. Let's start with the Bible. You are allowed to exempt up to $60 worth of Bible. Did you hear me?
Okay.
Yeah, you heard me. $60 worth of Bible.
There's a number.
How much cash are you able to exempt? So these are when you put all these assets on the So when I go into the court, I essentially take all your assets and I put them on the table in front of the trustee, and then I go, okay, now give me back the Bible because that's exempt. Now, give me back the house because there is enough to $50,000 worth of equity there, so it's exempt. I take the house back. Now, give me back the car because it's not up to $2,400 worth of equity in the car. I take the car back. Now, give me the gun. It's not up to $400. I take it back. Give me the furniture in the living room. Give me the TV. Give me the bed. So there are exemptions for every class of asset, and my job as a bankruptcy attorney is to identify all of those exemptions and make sure that everything you own fits underneath that line so that even though theoretically I dump all your assets on the table, by the time the conversation is over, I'm taking it back with me.
Wow.
So it's called a no asset. The bankruptcies I do are called no asset bankruptcy because even though the person does have assets, I have been able to show that each one of those assets are exempt, in which case we take the assets with us and there is nothing to give the creditors, and the creditors go home zero, zip, zilch.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay. Or, well, at least you get to go home with your stuff.
Yeah, you get to go home with your stuff. It's another misconception. Will I lose my living room, my couch, my settee, my lights, my Bible? No, you don't lose any of that stuff because there are exemptions under the law that protect all that stuff. Your retirement, up to $1 million in your 401k or IRA, protected. So people will say, oh, I can't file a bankruptcy. I've been saving in my IRA and my 401k since I was 30. I've got about $800,000 in there. If I file, I'll lose it. No, you won't. It's exempt, completely exempt, 100%.
Just make sure that your Bible is not worth more than $60.
Exactly. If your Bible is some kind of antique, like the ones that Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John actually signed off on, then, you know, you got a problem there. But short of that, I guarantee your Bible is not worth more than $60, so you'll get to keep that. And everything else, your computer, your printers, your mirror, your shoes. If you were collecting furs from back in the 70s and you've got all these mink stoles and things worth thousands and thousands of dollars, okay, you might have a problem. The bankruptcy trustee might want to see that. If you collect jewelry, if you're some kind of bling enthusiast, you've got $80,000, $90,000 worth of bling, that could be your problem because the trustee I may not be able to exempt that for you. But for the most of us who just have a closet full of suits and shoes and belts and hair pieces and eyeglasses and watches and furniture and a nice 60-inch screen with a DVD and Blu-ray and PlayStation, you'll be fine.
Okay. Well, then let's go to Chapter 13. If we're done with Chapter 7.
Chapter 11 is the one that you see corporations do. It's a reorganization.
Right, right. So
and I think that is...
And 13, right.
Yeah. A 13 is what's called a wage earners plan, you know. The idea is I can't exempt all of my assets under a Chapter 7 filing, like what I described to you where we go to the table and we take it back, right?
Yeah.
I can't do it. Why? Because there's $300 worth of equity, $300,000 worth of equity in my home, right?
Okay.
So if I go into a 7, they're going to take the home. Or, you know, I make so much money that I don't pass the means test. So there are a couple of reasons why you can't do a 7, so you get kicked into a 13. And a 13 is called a wage earners plan because what the court tries to do in that situation is say, okay, you don't want a full discharge. What you're looking for is for someone to help you create a plan by which you give certain amount of money to the court and the court takes care of all these people for you. So the court essentially helps you come up with a budget. You propose a plan, the court blesses the plan, and whatever that plan says is what happens. So it could be something as simple as there's, you have your home and you've got your first mortgage on it, and all of a sudden you took out a second mortgage on it, but now the property value, so you had a home and it was a $300,000 home, you owe $300,000 on it. And then one day you decided, so, you know, market valuations, you know, someone told you your house is now worth $400,000, so you got an additional $100,000 line of equity on it. Well, guess what happens? Market prices have now crashed. The house is now worth $300 or less. So you can, in a Chapter 13, one of the things that we try to do is you say, okay, why don't we strip off the second mortgage because it's not secured? Let's get that forgiven, because if we forgive that $100,000, this person can pay the $300,000. But that $100,000 is no longer a secured debt. So a Chapter 13 is a plan by which secured creditors get at least most of their money, and unsecured creditors are still in the same bad situation. They get nothing.
Okay. In fact, that's great, because that is one of the questions that I received from someone who had sent me a question by email having to do with the consequences and the strategy that's involved in dealing with secured debt versus unsecured debt. Could you explain for the listeners what the difference is between secured debt and unsecured debt?
Secured debt is your mortgage. It's your car note. Unsecured debt is your credit card. Without getting into the legal jargon, those are the general classes that people deal with on a daily basis. A security simply means that there is collateral for that debt. When you go to borrow money to buy a house, guess what the collateral for the house is? For the debt is. It's the house.
Right.
So that debt is secured by the house. When you go to borrow a car note, the money you took to buy the car is secured by the car. The car is the collateral for the loan, so it's a secured debt. When you go to take credit card debt, there is no security. You just swipe and go. Make sure you pay every month or file a bankruptcy.
Okay. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the difference between secured debt and unsecured debt.
Exactly.
Right. So let me ask the question. You may have already sort of answered this, but I just want to make sure that it's been covered. The question that I received was, does it make more sense in terms of establishing good credit later on down the road to clear the unsecured debt I have through bankruptcy, or simply to accept it as a charge-off?
A charge-off is not good for two reasons. One, a charge-off really just goes to your credit report as if you refuse to pay. You know, they make it sound like it's okay, but when it gets on your credit report, it really is written up as if these people realized that you were such a deadbeat, there was no way you were going to pay, so they just took the loss, right?
Yeah.
But even more important than that is that if you get a credit card company to forgive you for $20,000 worth of debt, not only does it go on your credit report and do real damage there, because it shows up as if you just kind of walked away from it, they couldn't find you, skipped the country. But even more important, you have cancellation of debt income.
Oh, it goes to your taxes.
Oh, yeah. You have to go report that $20,000 as income. So, you know, assuming you made, you know, $100,000 that year, make sure that you report $120,000 or the government will come after you. Because after they forgive you for that $20,000 worth of debt, they're going to send the government a 1099-C or D, whatever it is, 1099-something for cancellation of debt. And the government's going to have it on file that you were just giving a check for $20,000. And you better report that or you will get an audit.
So if the credit card doesn't get you, the government will.
It doesn't what?
So if the credit card company doesn't get you, the government will.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Somebody will. You'll pay someone.
Okay.
Whereas if you had filed
a
bankruptcy.
Pardon?
Yeah. The cancellation of debt issue, section 108 of the Internal Revenue Code, cancellation of debt has exemptions, and one of the exemptions to reporting that income is if the debt was discharged in a bankruptcy.
Oh, right. Okay. So let's make sure we've got this straight. If you have your debt canceled by the credit card company, so that's what a charge off is. If your debt is canceled by the credit card company directly, rather than having your debt wiped out in bankruptcy, they're going to report that to the IRS. And so you use the number 20,000. So using the number 20,000, it will look as though you received $20,000 in income. If you file for bankruptcy, then you're telling me that $25,000 or $20,000 cannot be written off in bankruptcy?
It will be written off. It will be discharged in a bankruptcy.
Oh, it will be discharged in bankruptcy. Okay.
It will be discharged, but then you won't have to worry about the cancellation of debt income.
Right. So it's better to go ahead and do the bankruptcy before you even – it's better to avoid having a charge-off is basically what you're saying.
Yeah. I don't know why. you know how we started by saying this is going to be an individualized approach. I can't make that statement for the majority I can't make that general statement because it's really going to depend on your situation. What if you don't qualify for a bankruptcy? Then you need to take the charge off.
Okay.
Or what if, you know, that's the only debt that's really messing you up? You're fine everywhere else. This one thing is what's holding you down. If you can get rid of it, you can get back on track very quickly. So I would have to look at your situation, but I'm just saying on a very basic level, be aware of cancellation of debt income. I have a client right now who has $800,000 worth of COD hanging around his neck because the banks forgave some debt for him. It happens all the time.
Okay. Now, I'm going to go to the phone line again. We have somebody who has called in and seems to want to be on the air. So this is in the 347 area code. Caller, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is Batavila. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I forgot about it. I tried to get on early, but it was too early. And I said, I'll get to try later.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Well, I have a talk show. Yes, I have a talk show about the Bible on Mondays and Wednesdays night. So why I can't get on your talk show?
Well, if you are interested in being a guest on the show, please go ahead and contact me through Blog Talk Radio. Did you have a question for my guest today?
No, I just got on.
Okay, so why don't I do this? I'm going to go ahead and put you back in the queue, and after the show, you can contact me through Blog Talk Radio. All right, well, thank you so much for calling, and again, if you have a question that's not related to the show, I encourage you to send me email at info@123untangled.com, or you can actually become a friend of the show and send me a message that way through Blog Talk Radio directly. We are coming down to the last 10 minutes of the show here, and actually we're going to need to reserve a little bit of time for an announcement toward the end. Let me actually go ahead and take this moment. We have Mother's Day coming up, talking about this show, and I want to have that show be an opportunity for people to declare their appreciation for their mothers. So on Mother's Day, we will have a show that's dedicated to the idea of motherhood and also where our phone lines will be open so that you can call in and let your mom know how you feel about her and thank her for the things that she has done for you. So I want to make sure to get that announcement out there, and I'll be making announcements as we come down toward Mother's Day, but I want people to know that they have an opportunity to do that coming up. All right. So, Zelma, back to the issue of bankruptcy. I want to make sure that I've answered the questions that have come in. There was a question about rent here, and I know that we very briefly touched on rent, but the question has to do with what are the consequences of including rental arrears in a bankruptcy for future renting and home-owning considerations?
Rental arrears, so you haven't paid your landlord.
Yes.
That's an interesting one. I don't think I've ever, I think I know the answer, but then I'm reaching back and wondering if I've ever seen the issue myself. If you owe your landlord rent and you don't pay, he can, bankruptcy or not, he can move to have you evicted.
Okay.
So, you know, if you have arrears to your landlord, he always has the right of eviction. And I'm pretty sure bankruptcy doesn't stop that. So the idea of arrears being discharged in bankruptcy may be moot in that I don't – you can discharge them. Okay, two different issues. One is you can discharge – you can have 2 years' worth of arrears to your landlord and we can discharge him in a bankruptcy, but be sure that he's then going to move for eviction and have you removed.
Right.
You'll never be able to collect on the back rent, but you will be removed.
Okay. And just to make sure then – let's say that you have this arrears, and before you file for bankruptcy, you are removed from the property. You are evicted from the property. Does the landlord still then have an opportunity to try to collect on those arrears in bankruptcy?
Well, let me just make a very flat statement that is always true. Bankruptcy clears all debts, with the few exceptions I told you, which should be student loan and domestic support obligations. you can just assume that if you file, everything goes. Everything you owe the landlord, that goes.
Okay.
In fact, the arrearage, the 2 years of arrears you owe on your house because you haven't paid and now you're in foreclosure and they're not moving as quick enough, now you owe them $70,000 in arrears, that gets cleared. The only problem is that, especially with secured debts, when I file a bankruptcy for you, the $4,000, the $8,000 you have in arrears on your Mercedes, I clear that. The only problem is you better believe that Mercedes will come and take the car.
I see. Okay.
Your
okay.
house, you owe $60,000 worth of arrears. You haven't paid them in 12 months. I'll clear that. The bankruptcy will clear that. But they'll come and take their house. They're not going to ever come after you for the debt, but they'll take the security. That's why it's called secured debt. Same thing with the example you gave with the landlord. If you were to do it with a landlord, you know, landlords owed you, and I've had clients like this, you know, been with gone to court with the landlord, lost, the landlord comes up, and now they owe the landlord $20,000 and another $6,000 in attorney fees. We filed a bankruptcy, it's gone. The only thing is, at that point, you better believe the landlord is going to come in and ask for his space back.
Okay, so even if the court gave you back the assets because they came in under the line, as we talked about just a little earlier, the creditor who was a secured creditor can still come and take that asset.
Well, he won't. That's what I'm saying. If we go, some people come to me with a bankruptcy. I just did a bankruptcy, a guy who owns seven different properties between New York and New Jersey. He wanted to get rid of them. He'd made so many bad investments that he wanted to kill it all and start new again. We just handed it over to the trustee and walked away.
Okay.
Now, if you want to go and have me save your house, that doesn't mean that a bank is going to come and take it. The bank doesn't want your house, but that just means you need to continue to pay for it. You can't live in it for free.
I see. Okay, of course.
A bankruptcy will never buy you the right to live in your house for free or to live in your rental for free.
Right.
What it will do is if you want to get rid of that debt completely, we can file and it'll be gone. But you have to give up the asset that secures it.
Uh-huh.
If you want to keep that asset, then you need to go back and get into conversations with your creditor. It's called a reaffirmation agreement in which we call up your creditor and we say, okay, we filed a bankruptcy. We have been discharged from this debt. But seeing as we still want to live in this house, we want to reaffirm the debt with you. So the debt will come back on brand new, and we would continue to service it.
Okay.
But now we would have got rid of all of the credit cards. You know, you owed $60,000 worth of credit cards or $30,000 or whatever. We've gotten rid of that, and now the only debt you have to focus on is your home. And now you can pay your mortgage because you don't have to pay out so much on the other kinds of debt.
Right, right. Wow. Well, that is an awful lot of knowledge. I'm hoping that in there, the questions that listeners had have been answered. Again, one last time, how can people contact you?
212-312-7214. That's the best way to contact me.
Okay, fantastic. Zoma, thank you so very much for coming on. This is Mr. Eze. We're friends, so I'm used to calling you by your first name, but Mr. Eze.
Oh, my first name is fine. I prefer my first name. Uzoma is just fine.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You have done a fantastic job, I think, doing this great public service, letting people know that.
Oh, you're just saying that.
No, seriously. You know, the idea that you can't get relief through bankruptcy because debt can drive a person crazy. And
yeah.
You know, so knowing that you can get out from under it, and that there are, you know, practitioners out there, you want to have somebody who is as confident as you are and as knowledgeable as you are to sort of hold your hand and guide you through the process, so that you can live a life that's free of this kind of terror that debt can bring on a person.
Yeah, because some of this debt actually starts to approximate modern day. Indebted servitude. It really is true. And you have to have that conversation because there are ways. I'm not saying that a bankruptcy is always there, but, you know, burying your head in the sand and turning away. The statute of limitations on debt collection is 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what that means? Most statute of limitations run between 2 years and 5 years.
Right.
Debt collection is 20 years. You think that's a mistake? No. It means that this thing can be following you for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
Right.
And each time you make a payment, the 20-year statute resets.
Wow.
I can collect a debt for you for 20 years, from you for 20 years. So if you stop paying me for 20 years and I can't collect it within that 20 years, the debt goes away. But guess what? If you make the mistake of making one payment, it resets for another 20 years. So debt can actually be something that will stay with you throughout your natural life. And the idea that you could go and hide your head in the sand or out of shame not have a conversation or discussion or try to get to the bottom of it, it just beats me. Talk to someone. Have a conversation. The answer may be, whatever the answer is, I guarantee you it'll be better than the situation that you're with right now, because you're living with a lot of misinformation, a lot of really, really bad facts that you think are real because your grandparents and your aunts and your uncles have told you it's true. It's just not true. You need to talk to someone who actually knows. There are solutions out there. I'm yet to meet a client who did not leave me feeling better than when they came in. And this is whether they retained me or not. This is whether I worked with them or not. The mere fact is talking about it just kind of shines a light on it that you never thought possible.
Right, right. So the upshot is get help. Get help.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Get help.
Thank
There's just
you.
Too many resources out there.
Right. Thank you so very much for being on the show. And I hope that you who are listening have enjoyed the show. Tune in again next week. We're going to have a brand new exciting topic for you. If there's something that you'd like to hear addressed on the show, give me a line, drop me a line, info@123untangled.com. Be sure to hit that little button that says follow on the show there on the internet, and you will get updates of the upcoming show so that you never miss one. And find us on Facebook. We're at 123untangled. On Facebook, and like the page there. So let me know that you are there and you're listening. We're going to finish up with a piece from Mark Taylor's brand new CD. It's called At What Age? And the piece is called My One and Only. Enjoy and have a wonderful, wonderful week.
The handshake, kiss on the cheek, welcome as the players gather backstage. The lights poise. Podium, microphone, pitcher of water for the dry-throated reader set in place. The host reviewing the list, who's first, what follows, and how will the night proceed towards the finale. A nervous chatter in the corner reveals the unexpected last-minute adjustment. Where is he? Did he call? No, I'm sure he's okay. He never misses a chance to prance upon the stage. But his wife, you know she left him. And the kids, they're all off to college. Dedicated fans, novices, and the ever-present note-takers, eager to catch every sliver of inspiration flung across the room, indexing words, potential images, the witty line, so they too can one day ascend onto the stage bathed in light. Thank you. straightens his tie, pulls the tail of his jacket with a quick jerk, wrinkles succumbing to the square-shouldered confidence of this prestigious hall. It's poetry month, with the red carpet rolled out. Time for the closet connoisseurs to pull out that one favorite poem, symbolizing all that poetry is, has been, and will ever be in their lives. Remembering the bifocal English teacher, grandparent, uncle, aunt, close friend, who shared this jewel of verse at just the right moment, or the reading protest march speeches, where the stanzas proclaimed the perfect, precise, pared-down statement, caught in the image of a child on a lake or hill, or sitting at daddy's knee, or mommy's. It all comes down to this one epiphany. This is my favorite, one and only, truly great inspiration, says the third reader standing at the podium. And since then, no other poem has been necessary. On the cheek, welcome, as the players gather backstage. Yes, since then, no other poem has been written.